So today, a very amazing end to an incredible saga destined to be a full-length Hollywood movie someday happened. I presume that you know about the cave rescue in Thailand. And just as a lead into what I'm going to say about it, I'll mention a koan. And this koan is from a group of approximately 50 or 100 quasi koan called preliminary koan. They're kind of practice koan that are assigned to a student who has successfully passed a breakthrough koan, such as Mu or Who Am I? And the point of these koan is to get the student familiar with moving through various stories and freeing up their ability to demonstrate an answer that is not intellectual, but something coming from a deeper place. So one of the koan is, there's a few variations on it. One of the ways it goes is that you were wrongly accused of a crime and you were thrown into a dungeon. All there was in the dungeon was a bench and nothing more. The key was turned, the door was locked, the jailer went away, and you were condemned to life. And this was for a crime you did not commit. And the question in the koan is, what do you do now? Now, the answer that a Zen student would ordinarily come up with actually is not the correct answer for this koan. Be that as it may, the correct answer will probably at some point fail, and then eventually the ultimate answer that most Zen students would come up with will potentially come into play. Either that or you're going to really, really suffer. Now, something like that happened. So I don't understand all the details of this story, but I'm going to tell it in a brief fashion from what I've read and heard. And I'm sure that the true events will come out eventually when everybody has been interviewed, and eventually when the book is written, and then when the movie, which I can't wait for, will inevitably be made and then shown. And this will be a blockbuster. So what happened was there was a some kind of a soccer match or a festival of some kind in Thailand. And one of the teams was named the Wild Boars. And this team was made up of 12 young boys from the ages of 11 to 16. And their coach was a young man. He was 25. I believe his name was Ek. I don't know if that's a Thai name, but it was, I think what I read was E-K. So I will just call him Ek. Anyway, they finished their matches. I'm not certain if they won or if they won one or two games, but in celebration, and I guess they had planned this, Ek, the 25-year-old coach, led the 12 boys into a very well-known cave near where the match was held. And they were going to walk in. I think the entry to the cave was pretty well known, and they were going to walk in to a wide opened area within the cave, this dark cave. I'm sure they had flashlights or something. And they were all going to sign their names on the wall. And this would be the capper of their wonderful soccer, perhaps a weekend or week. I'm not certain about the details. Well, what happened was they entered the cave, and then all of a sudden it started to rain really hard. And this is a time of year in Thailand, in this particular part of Thailand, I suppose, where they can get very sudden cloud bursts and torrential rains. And what happened was the rain obviously left runoff. It was so heavy that there was a lot of runoff, and water always seeks the lowest point. and it entered the cave and began to flood the tunnels of the cave. And as it flooded the tunnels of the cave, some of which were quite small, that the boys and the coach had to squeeze through, they were now completely underwater and their exit was blocked. And the water was rising. And their only chance of survival was to go deeper into this pitch black, watery cave that they, I'm assuming, didn't know quite well beyond that initial entryway. What happened was eventually they ended up 1.5 miles from the entrance, having passed through tiny little squeeze-throughs, long dark tunnels lined with razor-sharp rocks, and finally got to a slightly elevated cavern within this cave, pitch dark, where the water had not yet reached, and they stopped there. And it kept raining. And there was no exit. And there was no way to get any message out. And they may or may not have known whether anyone knew they were even in the cave. Perhaps someone told someone that they were going in the cave. Maybe they hoped that they would be found. And perhaps they believed that they never would be found. But 9 days went by. 9 days. I believe they had a little bit of food that had been consumed. They were probably drinking water out of the floor of the cave. And the boys were getting extremely thin and weak. And it was pitch dark. Their lights were gone. There was no way to communicate with the outside world. They had only the 13 of them. Now, this is the incredible story. They didn't know it, but the world knew they were in there, and the Thai Navy, who had frogmen who were highly skilled in cave rescues, which, incidentally, as a diving technique, is extremely fraught, extremely dangerous. I am a diver. I don't do that kind of technical diving. But in your learning about diving, you do learn that cave diving is uniquely dangerous. And one of the reasons it is dangerous is that if something goes wrong, you can't just go straight up for air. You have to get out of the cave. Now, I did once do a cave dive. I did a cave dive in Mexico, in the area of Cancun. There are some very famous freshwater caves. They're called cenotes. And they're full of very clear, fresh, very cold water. And you enter these caves, and within 10, 15, 20 feet, you're inside a cave where there is absolutely no air at all. It's completely water, and you're surrounded by cave, and it's pitch dark. And you have flashlight, and you have a very skilled dive master who, him or herself, is actually carrying 2 tanks just in case anyone has a tank problem. They have them strapped to their sides. And you follow a line that is already in the cave, and you're told to never let go of this line, and to always stay in contact with this line, and to follow each other single file as you enter this cave and shine with your flashlight at these incredible formations and just have the experience of being in a very unique diving environment. But it's dangerous. It's safe the way they run it, but in general, cave diving is probably the single most dangerous form of diving. And these frogmen, I guess one of them, or several of them, entered the cave and began to search for these boys and their coach. They played out a line. They had a long cord that they played out. And they kept failing to find anything because they were going deeper and deeper. It was extremely difficult with their equipment because they had to go through small squeeze-throughs. If the equipment gets caught in the cave, you can die. And in fact, that happened to one of the rescuers, because you're trapped and you can easily run out of air and you can panic. And panic in these situations can be quite deadly. So these divers have to be supremely trained, supremely courageous and skilled. So one day they made the deepest push into the cave. This was the ninth day after these boys disappeared. And the diver who was leading the way now had gone about a mile and a half into the cave, down a new channel, all underwater. Some of the places they were able to stand up and there was some air, but then they had to go through dive-throughs again that were filled completely with water, and it was getting worse. And their cord ran out. And they hadn't found the boys. But as I understand it, this diver went a little further because he was still within a single tunnel. And right at the point where he was going to turn around, he emerged into the cavern, and there was the coach, Eck, and the 12 boys seated in Buddhist meditation. Eck was an orphan, and he was raised by the abbot of a small temple, and you know Thailand is a Buddhist country, and he was quite trained in meditation. Let's call it Zazen. So some point along the way, and we'll hear the whole story of this being trapped in a cave with very little hope of ever being found, did the one thing that he could do that was potentially the greatest gift that he could give these poor kids that he had led into the cave to their almost certain death. And that was to teach them how to sit and all sit together in this cavern. And they were found, and after another 7 or 8 days, this is now a total of 2 weeks, with the fear of much heavier rains, today was the day they got the last four out of the cave, and several of the rescuers in the cave is now empty. And everyone except that one poor frogman, about halfway through the rescue attempt, on day 5 or 6, who died, everyone survived, and the boys are now recovering in the hospital. So what's the point of this? What is this practice? And why would it help in a situation like this? One would ordinarily think what would help would be, you know, running around, shouting, trying to get out. But when every other avenue is blocked, what else do you have? Now, perhaps you can tell each other stories. You can pray. Or you can enter your precise situation. Enter it. Remember that koan about the monks asking the master, sometimes this monastery is incredibly hot and sometimes it's unbearably cold. What can we do? And he said, well, go to the place where it's neither hot or cold. And the monk said, well, where is that place? And he said, when hot, let it be so hot that it kills you. When cold, let it be so cold that it kills you. What is this kills you? What does that mean, kills you? It's not literal. You don't go into heat stroke, have a seizure and die. That's not what he's talking about. What is he talking about? What kind of hot and cold situations have all of us been in at various points in our life? Perhaps right now. What cave with no exit have we found ourselves in at some point along the way in our very complicated lives with so many twists and turns? How many times have we been in a place, perhaps not that extreme, but to us it felt that extreme. And what would be the ordinary attitude towards it and reaction to it? It would be to remember how wonderful everything was before this situation arose, and be missing the people you can no longer see terribly, or the circumstance that you used to be in that seems gone forever, missing it, comparing this present misery to some perhaps more perfectly remembered series of heaven-like situations that you believe you had in the past. And then almost certainly saying, why me? Why did I deserve this? How could this have happened? Perhaps blaming, whatever. This is a human reaction. We've all done this. Now something changes along the way in Zen practice. Specifically, the practice of attending to your present condition exactly as it is. Attending to it. So that you attend so intently to the sensations of each moment that the you who is comparing, the you that is naming, putting this unique set of sensations into various categories and liking or disliking them, wanting to hold on to them or get rid of them, comparing them to someone else's situation, etc., 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 peters out and stops. And that person, that way of being, at least for the time that you are doing real Zazen, is killed. Let it be so what it is that it kills you. Now, why does this help? What happens in this state? One begins to understand that the condition that one is in is, in a sense, perfect. Perfect. It could not have been different. And it is perfectly manifesting its fact. When you are no longer struggling with its meaning, its particularities, and how to evade them or get rid of them, because now you're doing Zazen and you know that you're moving in a different direction, something begins to shine from each and everything. Whether it is pleasant or unpleasant, painful or pleasurable, it shines from this. It is shining. And that's what Eck taught these boys to do, to enter their exact situation, to make no ideas about it. In the words of Milarepa, Tibetan master of old, he said, abandon hope and fear. To abandon hope and abandon fear and enter your exact situation. So Zazen in this manner becomes sensory, not intellectual. It becomes direct, not a means to some future end. It becomes exactly what it is. So the boys in this cave and their orphan counselor, 25 years old, trained in meditation, have come through an incredible experience that we're all waiting to hear more about, that I think will be quite mind-opening, eye-opening, heart-opening, when we get all the details. So I want to just read a little bit now from a book called Zen Training, and this is by a master who's now dead. I've read from various of his writings before, and his name is Katsuki Sekida, S-E-K-I-D-A, Sekida. Just want to read a little bit from here. So here he's talking about Zazen and about a sensory approach to Zazen. So just to bring us back to our actual situation here. So he's talking now about working on the koan mu, but you can apply this to any kind of Zazen, particularly Shikantaza. So he says here, we can distinguish two kinds of attention, abstract and sensory. The former operating independently of the sense organs, the latter employing them. Sensory attention is, of course, of various kinds, visual, auditory, bodily, and he goes into this. Zazen practice sensory attention is more effective than abstract attention. The latter, abstract attention, becomes exhausted rather quickly. If you simply work abstractly on mu, you will rather quickly be overcome by wandering thoughts. But if you use your visual attention to look into yourself, and more precisely, to look into the tanden, which is the hara, so the lowest part of your abdomen, you will reach a state of awareness of your existence itself. This is natural. This is the natural outcome of this intent mindfulness to your actual condition. At the very bottom of this, when the mind quiets, and the meaning of your situation, how it fits in a bigger scheme, how it's going to lead to some future thing that you feel you lack now. When that all dies down, your sheer being begins to naturally become evident to you. It's not that you've created it. It's not that it just suddenly turned on like flicking on a flashlight. It's always been there. It only is ignored when we are involved with abstract attention. Meaning, conceptualization. So he says here, you will reach a state of awareness of your existence yourself, and you will also find that you are steadily getting into absolute samadhi. Profound silence envelops you. It is as if you were going down into the depths of the sea, ultimately to settle on the bottom of it. So it's interesting. He's using imagery that aligns with the story that we just learned happened in Thailand, and kind of the same approach. So this wonderful counselor, soccer coach, knew that there was just one thing that they could do, which was to enter their condition. It's like that song I remember from the 60s or 70s. I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in. Is in. This is what Zazen is. Dropping in to see what condition your condition is in. In other words, to enter your actual condition. Your actual condition is sensory. And you enter it. And that is enough. And that opens the door to this presence, existence, shining. And even in a cave, you can see that you lack nothing. So we'll end there today.